Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
And you are joining us for, well, what is without a doubt the most concentrated burst of federal government activity we have ever tried to process in a single deep dive.
It's a lot to get through.
It really is. This is the Federal News Update for Tuesday, December 16th, 2025.
That's right. Our listeners shared a truly massive stack of source material. I mean, it covers the full spectrum of U.S. federal activity.
We're talking executive orders that redefine national security, intense congressional maneuvering,
surprising judicial intervention, and some really crucial agency restructuring. And all of this has unfolded just since the stroke of midnight, Monday, December 15th, 2025.
So our mission is to take this bureaucratic flood, which, you know, it spans all three branches of government and touches everything from supply chains to your healthcare subsidies, and really dissect it with granular detail.
We want to give you the immediate consequences and, maybe more importantly, the long-term implications.
Essentially, giving you a shortcut to understanding how the machinery of Washington just fundamentally shifted over the last 24 hours.
And if we zoom out for just a second, just to get a high-level synthesis of what Monday was all about, it was really characterized by one overwhelming doctrine: total integration.
Total integration. What do you mean by that?
Well, we saw the administration deliberately blurring the operational lines between national defense, domestic law enforcement, and even public health.
So they're treating core domestic policy challenges as if they're existential national security threats.
Exactly. And that demands a military-style response, not a purely civilian one. I mean, Monday was really the operational launchpad for an entirely new governing philosophy.
Okay, let's unpack that aggressive integration.
Yeah.
I think we have to start with the most profound executive action of the day: the transformation of a public health crisis into a military target.
We have to. It's the executive order, the EO, that designated fentanyl as a weapon of mass destruction, a WMD.
And this isn't just, you know, abstract political posturing.
No, not at all. This is a radical legal reclassification. It activates wartime authorities, and it fundamentally alters the rules of engagement right here on U.S. soil.
I found the justification they provided in the EO to be extremely precise. It moves way beyond the standard drug enforcement rhetoric we're used to hearing.
It does. It explicitly states, and I'm quoting here, that illicit fentanyl is closer to a chemical weapon than a narcotic.
And that specific language is the linchpin, isn't it? It's what locks this entire legal mechanism into place.
It's everything. The EO establishes this quantitative threat, noting that a lethal dose is only 2 milligrams.
Which is an undetectable amount. It's what, equivalent to 10 or 15 grains of table salt?
Exactly. And it's that extreme lethality coupled with the mass production capability that's being used to establish the legal predicate they need to trigger WMD statutes.
Okay, so here's where the legal shockwave hits. That WMD designation, it unlocks an exception within a law that has strictly limited the military's domestic role for nearly 150 years, the Posse Comitatus Act. Walk us through that. What is the immediate legal gravity of touching that act?
Well, the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 is historic. I mean, it generally prohibits using federal military forces for domestic law enforcement. It's what maintains that crucial separation between the military and civilian life.
But there's an exception.
There is. Federal law, specifically 10 U.S.C. 282, carves out a critical exception for emergencies involving weapons of mass destruction.
So by legally defining fentanyl as a WMD,
yeah,
the president has effectively circumvented Posse Comitatus.
That's it. It transforms the war on drugs from, you know, a political slogan into a legally justifiable military engagement that could potentially involve active duty troops on American soil.
Which means we're looking at operational integration across multiple massive departments. The EKO even provided a sweeping table of operational assignments. So how are these key federal players being mobilized?
The mobilization is comprehensive. First, you have the Department of Justice, the DOJ. They're immediately directed to pursue investigations and prosecutions using WMD enhancements.
And that's a huge deal because it allows prosecutors to leverage terrorism statutes, right?
It's massive. It dramatically increases federal prison sentences, and it shifts the entire criminal justice response. It goes from a standard drug offense model to a counterproliferation model. You're treating drug traffickers like WMD proliferators.
And the Treasury Department also gets a major role here, which injects this policy firmly into the domain of financial warfare.
Exactly. That's their specialty. Treasury is directed to pursue assets and financial institutions that support the manufacturing of fentanyl and its precursor chemicals.
And this immediately opens the door to applying IEPA sanctions.
Yes, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. That is the crucial legal authority the U.S. uses to target foreign entities using national security powers. This could lead to secondary sanctions, potentially targeting major Chinese state banks.
So the administration is using economic coercion to disrupt the upstream supply chain at the highest levels.
At the absolute highest levels.
And the final piece of this integration puzzle, it lands at the newly renamed Department of War, the DOW.
So the DOW is tasked with a couple of things. First, determining if military resources, we're talking personnel, surveillance, specialized units, should be provided directly to the DOJ under that newly activated WMD exception.
And second?
Second, they have to update their chemical incident directives. This means integrating what's called CBRN, doctrine chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear, into what were previously just standard border security operations.
So you can see what, the deployment of active duty chemical warfare units?
You could. Or advanced satellite surveillance, specialized counter-drone systems, the kind the military uses abroad, now being used along the southern border. It's a profound escalation in both resources and intent.
And that rhetoric, it also has these profound geopolitical implications. It establishes a nexus between crime and terror. The EO states that the production of fentanyl fund these entities' operations, which include assassinations, terrorist acts, and insurgencies around the world.
That language is highly, highly charged, particularly when you think about our neighbors.
With Mexico, for instance, the EO seems to challenge its sovereignty. It implies that the cartels are WMD-wielding foreign terrorist organizations.
It does. It says they're engaging in armed conflict over territory. This provides the administration with a potential casus belli, a justification for military action to conduct unilateral U.S. military operations.
Like drone strikes or special forces raids.
Right. And they'd be justified as counterproliferation operations, not traditional law enforcement assistance, which would let them bypass Mexican approval entirely.
And what about the message being sent to China?
Well, the Treasury Directive targets core precursor chemicals, which aligns the executive action with legislative efforts that are already in Congress, like the Stop Chinese Fentanyl Act.
So it creates a unified executive and legislative front for financial warfare against Beijing's chemical industry.
It does. It frames their involvement not just as a trade violation, but as complicity in the proliferation of WMDs. That raises the stakes exponentially in that diplomatic relationship.
This expansion of the military's domestic role brings us directly to a separate but, you know, very related source. A comprehensive report from Democratic lawmakers detailing the staggering financial and strategic cost of using the DOD for these border missions.
And the cost is alarming. The report found that the Pentagon diverted at least $2
billion. $2
billion. $2 billion intended for core military infrastructure and readiness, things like barracks, schools, and training programs, all to fund immigration enforcement missions along the southern border. It's a staggering amount of money pulled directly from the forces budget.
Let's slow down on that $2 billion figure. We promised granular detail. What specifically were the military programs that lost funding, and why does that matter for readiness?
Well, these were not marginal projects. These were projects critical to the quality of life and long-term readiness of the force.
For instance,
the specific cuts included funds earmarked for elementary schools at Fort Knox. That directly impacts military families' morale and retention. Funds were cut for a crucial medical and dental facility at Naval Air Station Whidbey Island.
So healthcare availability takes a hit.
It does. There were also diversions from Marine Corps barracks construction in Japan and a sophisticated jet training facility in Mississippi. And critically, nearly $1 billion alone was shifted just from necessary barracks repairs.
$1 billion.
Which means service members across the country are living in deteriorating conditions to fund border enforcement.
And the report specifically warns that military readiness will suffer as a direct result of these diversions, moving beyond just infrastructure to actual personnel deployment.
Right. The operational impacts are acute. The report noted that elite high readiness units, we're talking about the 10th Mountain Division and the 101st Airborne Division.
The Army's only air assault division.
That's the one. They were deployed to the border to perform missions like logistical support and surveillance for customs and border protection.
But these are the divisions that are supposed to be globally deployable for major national security missions.
Exactly. Their deployment to the border reduces their capacity for training, for resting, for standing ready for their core mission. It directly reduces overall military readiness.
And the total diverted funds, they broke down into several specific buckets in the report.
They did. The largest share, about $1.3 billion, went directly to troop deployment costs. That's calculated at an estimated $5.3 million a day on border operations.
A day.
Per day. And the report had testimony suggesting troops were often doing little more than standing around.
And the other costs.
Additionally, over $420 million was redirected to support immigration detention operations on military bases, including Fort Bliss.
And here's where the accountability issue comes in, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Fort Bliss facility received a huge chunk of that funding.
It did. $363 million. Yet ICE's own oversight unit found it violated at least 60 federal immigrant detention standards, including issues with sanitation and medical care. So the money was spent, but the standards were not met.
And the high cost of using military aircraft for deportation flights really stood out in the sources.
Oh, it highlights a significant waste. The department diverted at least $40.3 million just to pay for these flights.
And the cost comparison is pretty stark.
It is. A C-17 military aircraft, which has been used for deportations, costs roughly $28,500 an hour to fly.
Okay. And a civilian charter.
A civilian charter contracted by Homeland Security costs about $8,500 an hour. So that extra $20,000 per hour buys the administration very little beyond a military aesthetic for what is, at the end of the day, a civilian law enforcement function.
The report confirmed the administration had conducted at least 88 of these military deportation stops by the end of September.
That's right.
We also saw the administration approve a plan to temporarily detail military lawyers to the DOJ to serve as immigration judges just to help manage that massive 3.5 million case backlog.
Right. And that decision was made even though the Office of Legal Counsel advised the DOJ to reimburse the Department of War for the lawyers' services.
And has that reimbursement happened?
The lawmakers' report confirms that the vast majority of these funds have not been reimbursed to the DOW, even as the Department of Homeland Security recently received an unprecedented influx of $170 billion.
Which effectively makes DHS's budget larger than many countries' entire militaries.
It does. And the report's overall conclusion is blunt. It says, continuing to allow DHS to pick DOD's pockets puts our military readiness at grave risk.
Shifting our focus back to operational deployment, that aggressive posture continues in the Caribbean amid the Venezuela standoff, which resulted in a near miss involving a commercial airliner reported just yesterday.
The tension in the Caribbean is palpable. You can really feel it. The U.S. military presence remains robust, with the Pentagon positioning the USS Gerald R. Ford Carrier Strike Group and B-1 Lancer bombers operating near Venezuela's coast.
And the president's prior threats of land strikes mean the entire region is on high alert.
It does. And the aviation scare was confirmed by a JetBlue commercial pilot, which is deeply unsettling.
That's right. The pilot reported narrowly avoiding a mid-air collision with a U.S. Air Force refueling tanker operating near Venezuela.
And the critical issue was that the pilot claimed the tanker was not broadcasting its precise location. Its transponder was off.
And operating a military aircraft near crowded international airspace without broadcasting its location is just a massive safety hazard.
It is. Southcom acknowledged the incident and stated they are assessing the facts.
That near miss near Venezuela leads us directly to a debate happening in Congress, linking these external military operations with domestic safety standards. But speaking of which, the administration is clearly focused on threats abroad and at the border. But what happens when we turn our focus inward? How is this same doctrine of total control and ideological realignment reshaping the core civilian administrative state?
Well, we've seen the internal restructuring accelerate, and it really starts with the most dramatic public health paradigm shift in decades at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC.
The core personnel change was the swearing in of Dr. Ralph Abraham as principal deputy director of the CDC.
And Dr. Abraham is a highly controversial figure. He's a former Louisiana Surgeon General known for being a vocal vaccine skeptic.
So his appointment places an ideological opponent of the pandemic-era public health consensus directly at the operational helm of the CDC.
Right, serving under HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. This is personnel as policy. It signals a clear retreat from population-level mandate enforcement and a shift in the agency's scientific direction.
And this appointment was immediately followed by a major new directive, the Vaccine Alignment Memorandum, issued by the White House. What does this memorandum command?
The directive is really an administrative mechanism designed to force a change in U.S. vaccination policy. It mandates a comparative critique of the U.S. childhood vaccine schedule.
How so?
Well, the memorandum notes that the U.S. recommends vaccinating children for 18 diseases, while peer developed countries recommend significantly fewer. It cites Denmark, which recommends just 10.
And so it orders HHS and the CDC to update the United States' core childhood vaccine schedule if those foreign practices are deemed superior.
Precisely. So this is a strategic move to leverage the European model to reduce the recommended number of vaccines, particularly targeting those that have been controversial since the pandemic, like the COVID-19 shots for minors.
So it's an administrative maneuver designed to reduce the number of recommended vaccines by framing the reduction as aligning with superior European practices.
Exactly. It attempts to neutralize accusations of promoting anti-science policies. And Dr. Abraham's role ensures this ideological and policy shift is implemented aggressively. It fundamentally changes the agency's operational focus.
We're seeing a similar, though maybe more targeted, ideological alignment happening across the Department of State, specifically when it comes to promotions and internal policy fidelity.
Right. The State Department took a remarkable and controversial step by retroactively promoting 200 Foreign Service employees.
And they achieved this by unilaterally changing the promotion criteria and, critically, changing the composition of the promotion boards themselves, all without much transparency.
That's the key. So what was eliminated and what was installed as the new standard? The department eliminated diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility DEIA goals from the criteria entirely.
And its place.
In its place, the new standard focuses assessment on employees' fidelity to the Trump administration's policy goals. The scorecard now grades Foreign Service officers on 5 criteria: fidelity, communication, leadership, management, and knowledge.
That fidelity standard includes some surprisingly specific language for a diplomatic corps that's known for its neutrality and career expertise.
It really does. The fidelity portion specifically evaluates employees on their contributions to protecting and promoting executive power. And mid-level officers are assessed on how they are zealously executing U.S. government policy.
And the State Department actually justified this.
Explicitly. A spokesman argued the administration rewards excellence and that the previous administration imposed ideological litmus tests. This signals that career professionalism will now be subordinate to ideological alignment with the executive's agenda.
And the lack of transparency around these promotions has alarmed groups like the American Foreign Service Association, AFSA. Why is the secrecy around the promotion boards so concerning?
Well, AFSA expressed immediate alarm because the department refused to share the names of those promoted or the individuals who served on the promotion boards.
And that's highly concerning because prior Inspector General reports have specifically cited issues of nepotism and favoritism regarding board selections.
Exactly. Without transparency, it's impossible to determine if these 200 retroactive promotions were based on merit or political loyalty. An attorney for AFSA also noted that this unilateral rollout directly contradicts legislation previously passed by Congress, specifically related to the Foreign Service. They're preparing a legal challenge.
And the State Department is just one example of an agency facing major workforce turbulence. This brings us to the significant hiring and retention challenges currently engulfing the entire federal government, particularly at the Office of Personnel Management, OPM.
Yeah, the situation is rapidly deteriorating into a full-blown bureaucratic crisis. OPM Director Scott Kupor confirmed that federal retirement processing has slowed substantially.
How substantially?
OPM's application inventory is over 48,300. That is nearly quadruple the agency's target inventory of 13,000. And this bottleneck is having painful, real-world consequences. Processing time peaked at an average of 79 days in October.
79 days, just for OPM's part of the process.
Just for their part. And what's the single biggest factor driving this massive crisis? It's the sheer volume of departures driven by the Deferred Resignation Program, or DRP, coupled with chronic understaffing.
And the DRP led to the loss of over 300,000 federal employees this year.
That's right. And to put the volume in context, of the 35,000 retirement applications OPM received with a September retirement date, DRP retirees represented over 17,500 of them. Half of that month's total volume alone, OPM was simply not equipped to handle a surge of this magnitude.
and waiting 79 days for processing. I mean, that's catastrophic for families who need income immediately. What is the human impact on these retirees?
It's devastating. Retirees are effectively in the dark and unable to make financial plans. They are waiting months for critical payments, primarily their lump sum annual leave payouts,
which usually functions as a bridge payment.
Right, and their interim annuities, which are usually 60 to 80% of their final retirement payment. We've seen anecdotes of employees waiting 5 months for interim payments, leading to severe financial distress.
And this backlog is compounded by the fact that the HR departments responsible for handling these applications are also shrinking.
That's a key structural issue. HR staffing across the federal government has decreased by about 5% this year. That's about 2,600 employees lost. These are the very offices responsible for processing retirements, meaning they are overwhelmed and understaffed.
It's a perfect storm.
It is. Experts are describing the situation as the biggest test HR has ever faced in recent memory.
Amid this talent crunch, the Department of Education has been busy tightening the eligibility requirements for one of the government's key retention tools, the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, or PSLF.
This is a major change. A final regulation issued on Halloween substantially reshaped PSLF eligibility for employees and employers. The key transformation is that eligibility now operates not just on a status test, are you employed by a nonprofit, but a conduct test.
A conduct test, that sounds broad. How is education defining a substantial illegal purpose in these new regulations?
Well, they adopted the IRS's illegality doctrine, but then listed several specific enumerated activities that are deemed indicative of a substantial illegal purpose. And this list is highly specific and clearly targets current political flashpoints, such as aiding or abetting violations of federal immigration laws, supporting terrorism, the use of puberty blockers or sex hormones for minors in violation of law, and engaging in a pattern of violating state laws like trespassing or obstruction of highways.
That is an astonishingly granular list. How will the Department of Education enforce this new conduct test?
They will apply a preponderance of the evidence standard. Certain conclusive evidence, like a final court judgment or a guilty plea, will be presumed conclusive proof of illegal conduct. And crucially, the new regulations place the onus on qualifying employers to affirmatively certify that they are not engaged in these activities.
What's the ultimate impact on the student loan borrowers who rely on this program?
The full regulations don't take effect until July of 2026, so there's some runway. However, if an employer is disqualified, affected borrowers will retroactively lose credit toward loan forgiveness for all months worked after that determination date.
Amid this massive outflow of experienced talent and bureaucratic overload, OPM also announced a major new initiative aimed at shoring up critical technology expertise.
This is the creation of the U.S. Tech Force. OPM is aiming to hire 1,000 early career employees by the end of March, specifically targeting skills in AI, software engineering, and data science.
And these are not entry-level jobs?
Not at all. These roles are high-paying GS-13 and GS-14 level, with salaries ranging from about $130,000 to $195,000.
That's a huge investment of highly paid talent.
Yeah.
How does this compare to previous and recently shuttered government tech efforts, like the U.S. Digital Service or 18F?
Well, Director Kupor positioned this as fundamentally different, and the mechanism is key. This effort uses a pooled hiring model.
Meaning multiple agencies, defense, state, treasury, can select from a shared roster of vetted candidates rapidly.
Exactly. And crucially, these new hires will be full-time career track employees assigned directly to agencies to work on high-priority projects for two-year stints. It's a strategic move to address the tech gap quickly by providing high salaries and career stability.
So on one hand, we're hemorrhaging institutional memory, and on the other, we're trying to inject high-salaried, mission-driven new talent.
That's the tension. Rapid turnover meeting targeted infusion.
That internal federal focus on workforce and the administrative state, particularly in tech, leads us directly into the new regulations that are aggressively targeting technology vendors and financial markets.
Right. And the focus is governance around the explosion of artificial intelligence. The Office of Management and Budget, OMB, just issued a foundational memo setting new procurement guardrails for buying AI tools.
And this is set to reshape agency acquisition policies within 90 days or by March 11th.
Correct.
What are the two core philosophical principles OMB mandated for agencies acquiring large language models? Or LLMs.
They are concise and potent. New contracts for LLMs must ensure the tools are both truth-seeking and ideologically neutral.
Let's delve into truth-seeking. What does that even mean in the context of government-purchased AI?
It means that LLMs must prioritize factual information and objectivity. They must be designed to prioritize historical accuracy, scientific inquiry, and importantly, acknowledge uncertainty where reliable information is incomplete or contradictory.
So it's an attempt to mandate intellectual honesty in government AI tools.
You could put it that way, yes.
And the mandate for ideological neutrality, that directly fulfills one of the president's executive orders.
It does. The Preventing Woke AI in the federal government executive order is clearly being executed here. Ideologically neutral means that LLMs must operate as nonpartisan tools.
So developers are explicitly prohibited from intentionally encoding partisan or ideological judgments into an LLM's outputs.
Exactly. Unless those judgments are directly prompted by the user, for instance. If you ask for a summary of a specific ideological viewpoint, this mandate forces vendors to confront and defend the bias inherent in their training data.
What are the practical acquisition implications for the vendors hoping to sell these tools to the government?
Well, agencies must now obtain extensive vendor documentation to assess a vendor's risk management actions to ensure compliance. However, OMB did provide a concession by emphasizing that agencies should not require vendors to disclose sensitive technical data, like the proprietary model weights.
So it provides a way to ask tough questions without demanding trade secrets.
Right. One former acquisition executive framed this memo not as an impediment, but as a benefit, stating it provides acquisition professionals with the top cover needed to ask vendors much harder compliance-focused questions.
And the technical demands of AI aren't just changing acquisition. They are demanding a complete overhaul of the government's foundational infrastructure, the cloud architecture itself.
That's correct. The sheer explosive demand for AI compute power is fundamentally incompatible with traditional commercial cloud architecture. It introduces too much latency or lag, which just kills AI performance.
So the shift being mandated is toward a hyper-distributed model. Explain that for us. What is the goal here?
The goal is to distribute compute power and internet connectivity much closer to the physical cluster of end users. So if the user is on the West Coast, the server processing the AI request should be locally distributed.
To minimize latency.
Exactly. This is game-changing for AI applications that require instantaneous decision-making while also maintaining security and performance standards that must be higher than, say, common social media platforms.
But maintaining security compliance, specifically FedRAMP compliance, across such a distributed network seems incredibly challenging.
It is the central technical challenge. A Cloudflare expert, Anish Patel, discussed addressing this by embedding FedRAMP compliance directly into the distributed architecture itself.
So the idea is that distributed instances of an application inherit security control built into the original compliant version.
Exactly. A build it once, distribute it everywhere methodology. It's crucial for global agencies like the State Department, or for services like veterans accessing local medical care. The experience has to be secure and performant regardless of location.
Beyond technology, the executive branch also issued two important EOs aimed at antitrust and financial market governance, starting with the food supply chain.
Right. The president signed an order addressing price fixing and anti-competitive behavior in the food supply chain, elevating this issue to a national security threat.
And the rationale is that this kind of behavior, especially by foreign-controlled corporations, harms national security by destabilizing essential resources.
And hits family budgets hard. So what enforcement action is mandated by the EO? It establishes food supply chain security task forces within both the DOJ and the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC.
Which means mandating aggressive antitrust enforcement, including potential criminal prosecutions aimed at breaking up consolidation.
Exactly. Specifically citing meat processing and the markets for seeds and fertilizer. This is a robust populist use of antitrust power serving a nationalist economic agenda.
The second EO targeted the powerful world of proxy advisors, which seems aimed squarely at the ESG movement.
This order targets the duopoly of Institutional Shareholder Services, ISS, and Glass Lewis. They collectively control a staggering 97% of the proxy advisory market.
These are the firms that tell institutional investors how to vote on corporate governance issues.
Right. And the administration accuses these firms of prioritizing radical politically motivated agendas like environmental, social, and governance ESG over maximizing shareholder returns.
What's the regulatory mechanism being used to attack this duopoly?
The EO directs the SEC and the Department of Labor to review whether these firms should be required to register as investment advisors, which imposes significant fiduciary duties and regulatory burdens, and whether their coordinated activities violate existing antitrust laws.
So the strategic objective is clear: to cripple the ESG movement by disrupting the crucial information pipeline that facilitates shareholder activism.
That's it. By raising the cost and regulatory burden on ISS and Glass Lewis, the administration aims to quiet activist shareholders.
That gives us an exhaustive view of the executive branch's massive mobilization. Now, let's pivot our focus to the Hill, where policy battles over the budget, healthcare, and safety are reaching a boiling point with deadlines approaching rapidly.
And the most immediate and politically explosive deadline is the healthcare cliff.
That's the Enhanced Affordable Care Act, or ACA, subsidies expiring on December 31st. We are just 17 days away, and this expiration threatens massive premium spikes for roughly 24 million Americans.
The financial impact is immediate and dramatic. States like Florida, which lead the country in ACA marketplace enrollment, will be hit hardest. More than 1.5 million Floridians could face severe financial pain.
According to one nonprofit analysis, average premiums for some Florida residents could jump by a staggering 132%.
Which is about $521 annually. And as one Floridian quoted in the sources noted, for a household living paycheck to paycheck, that difference is absolutely vital. For many, it will force them to drop coverage entirely.
The Senate already failed to pass dueling proposals. So what's the path forward in the House where the clock is truly ticking?
Well, moderate Republicans, including Representatives Fitzpatrick, Kiggins, and Lawler, are attempting a last-ditch effort. They're trying to introduce an amendment in the House Rules Committee that would pair a two-year extension of the subsidies with eligibility reforms.
But the conservative wing of the GOP leadership is throwing up a major roadblock, insisting on spending cuts to offset the cost.
That's the sticking point. Leadership demanded that any extension must be offset with spending cuts, or pay-fors, which the moderates balked at. The cost is considerable, estimated by conservatives, at least $35 billion a year.
So if the moderates' amendment fails to get adopted in the Rules Committee meeting on Tuesday, what are their legislative options to avoid going over the cliff?
Their primary next step would be to push a discharge petition, such as the one backed by Kiggins and Gottheimer, which would force a floor vote if enough members sign on.
But some legislators are acknowledging that the new higher 2026 rates are already baked in because the open enrollment period is concluding.
Right. Even if Congress acts swiftly, the immediate financial pain for millions who have already signed up with the expectation of higher rates will be substantial, and it will lead many to drop their coverage altogether.
Which creates a spiral of adverse selection, weakening the entire ACA exchange system.
Precisely. When healthy people drop off due to cost, the remaining population is statistically sicker, driving premiums even higher for those who stay. It's a major systemic concern.
Moving from healthcare to defense, the National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, a must-pass bill, is moving to the Senate, but it carries a highly controversial and dangerous provision concerning aviation safety.
The NDAA passed the House and was scheduled for a procedural vote in the Senate Monday afternoon. The dangerous provision is a last-minute inclusion that would allow Army helicopter flights near Reagan National Airport in D.C. to return to operating without broadcasting their precise location.
Without using ADS-B.
Correct. And given the history in that area, that sounds incredibly risky.
Well, this lack of precise location broadcasting was the major contributing factor in the mid-air collision in January that tragically killed 67 people, involving a commercial airliner and an Army helicopter.
So this provision, if left in the NDAA, would effectively unwind the safety reforms implemented by the administration after that crash.
So who is leading the fight on the Hill to strip this out, and what leverage do they have?
Senator Ted Cruz and Senator Maria Cantwell held a press conference calling the provision a special carve-out that was airdropped in at the last moment.
And Senator Cruz threatened to hold up government funding.
He did. Until the Rotor Act, which requires all aircraft to broadcast their location, is passed. Senate Majority Leader John Thune expressed hope he could hold a separate vote to add the Rotor Act to a government funding package this week, hoping to avoid amending the NDAA and sending it back to the House.
Which would delay essential provisions like the planned pay increase for military personnel.
Exactly.
While Congress struggles with defense and health deadlines, the House is pushing full speed ahead with the regulatory rollback of environmental protections, particularly through the SPEED Act.
Right. H.R. 4776, the Standardizing, Permitting, and Expediting Economic Development Speed Act, was advanced by the House Rules Committee via a strong 9-3 vote.
And this is highly significant because it's a direct legislative assault on the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, which is the foundational law requiring environmental review.
It is. So what are the key elements of this bill that make it such a central piece of the drill, baby, drill agenda?
Well, it achieves its goal by drastically expanding the list of projects that are automatically exempt from detailed environmental review and by severely narrowing the definition of what constitutes a major federal action requiring that review.
And, critically, it imposes strict statutes of limitations on lawsuits challenging permits, often as short as 180 days after a decision.
That directly addresses industry complaints about lawfare, delaying projects for years in court.
It does. And the Rules Committee granted a structured rule, which is a procedural move that ensures the bill will pass the floor largely intact, preventing Democrats from offering crippling amendments.
Before we leave the domestic focus, the executive branch continues its push to classify a wide swath of federal employees as having a national security mission to eliminate their collective bargaining rights. We're seeing major action on this front from DHS.
That's right. Despite an ongoing court battle, DHS is once again moving to rescind the collective bargaining agreement, the CBA, with Transportation Security Administration TSA screeners. The new unilaterally imposed labor framework is set to be implemented on January 11th.
What is the administration's specific justification for eliminating the CBA for 47,000 airport screeners?
Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem determined that employees performing security screening functions have a primary function of national security and thus shall not engage in collective bargaining. TSA claimed that collective bargaining is inconsistent with efficient stewardship of taxpayer dollars.
And the union's counterargument.
The American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE, is vowing to fight the decision in court. They noted that a federal judge previously blocked DHS's prior attempt to dissolve the CBA, calling the move punitive. AFGE argues that having a union contract actually stabilized the workforce and reduced severe attrition rates.
This action is set against the backdrop of a broader high-stakes legal challenge concerning the president's expansive use of the national security exemption to roll back collective bargaining across the entire government.
That crucial case is currently before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. DOJ attorneys are arguing that the president is the expert when it comes to defining national security exemptions under the 1978 labor statute, and therefore courts should defer to his determination.
But the unions are strongly pushing back on the scope of that definition, arguing it's an attempt to nullify Congress's labor framework.
They are. Union attorneys pointed out that the executive orders cover entire departments, even if only a small portion of their work is national security related. For example, it covers K-12 teachers at DOD schools.
Or the entire Treasury Department, just because the secretary sits on the National Security Council.
Exactly. They argue this broad interpretation effectively nullifies most of Congress's federal labor relations scheme. The judges on the panel were really scrutinizing the limits of the president's discretion here.
Now, let's look at the judicial branch, which, in a seemingly routine order, delivered a profound strategic shield for the executive branch against legal challenges from public interest groups.
This is a critical, high-impact development in administrative law. The Supreme Court's action on Holman v. Rollins. On December 15th, the court granted, vacated, and remanded, or GVR'd the case.
For our listener, when the Supreme Court GVRs a case, it means they erased the lower ruling and sent the case back for reconsideration. Why is this specific order so strategically significant?
The court GVR'd the case in light of its recent Lackey v. Stinney precedent. And the Lackey ruling holds that simply obtaining a preliminary injunction, a temporary stop order, does not confer the prevailing party status required to recover attorney's fees under federal fee-shifting statutes.
That sounds technical, but what is the strategic consequence of applying this to Holman in future cases?
It creates a profound legal shield for the executive branch. Previously, if a public interest group challenged an aggressive policy and won a preliminary injunction halting it, they had a strong case to recover their substantial legal costs.
But
now, the administration has a massive incentive to implement aggressive policies, and if challenged, they can simply withdraw the policy once the preliminary injunction is issued, thereby mooting the case before a final judgment without ever having to pay the plaintiff's legal costs.
This dramatically raises the financial barrier for public interest groups to seek accountability, regardless of their political stripe.
Mm-hmm.
They now must fund costly litigation, knowing the government can simply pivot and leave them with the bill.
Precisely. It effectively allows the administration to weaponize litigation costs and pursue a strategy of policy by preliminary injunction, where they can test the limits of their power and, if challenged successfully, retreat without financial penalty.
Let's shift our focus now from domestic power struggles back to the world stage, moving from internal mobilization to global maneuvering and resource competition led by the State Department.
Right. Secretary of State Marco Rubio executed a key strategic pivot in South America focused entirely on securing critical resource supply chains, particularly targeting the region known as the Lithium Triangle.
This centers on the Status of Forces Agreement, or SOFA, signed with Paraguay.
The Paraguay SOFA provides a clear legal and operational framework for U.S. military personnel and Department of War civilian personnel operating within Paraguay's borders. This covers everything from training exercises to humanitarian assistance, essentially establishing a forward operational capability.
And the geopolitical significance hinges entirely on Paraguay's location relative to the world's most critical battery resource.
Exactly. Paraguay is strategically positioned adjacent to the Lithium Triangle, the intersection of Bolivia, Argentina, and Chile, which collectively holds 56% of global lithium reserves.
So this SOFA creates a forward operating base designed to counter aggressive Chinese influence in the Southern Cone.
It's a direct response to moves like Bolivia's major $1 billion lithium extraction deal with the Chinese firm CATL. The U.S. is projecting power to secure critical battery supply chains for electric vehicles and defense technology.
And in parallel, Secretary Rubio engaged in diplomatic outreach aimed at influencing Chile's mining policies.
He held a high-level call with Chile President-elect José Antonio Kast, a conservative figure who aligns ideologically with the current U.S. administration. This outreach seeks an opportunity to reverse Chile's recent nationalization trends in its massive lithium and copper sectors. The goal is to reopen these sectors to American mining investment.
Finally, we turn to the intensive and surprisingly quiet progress in the Ukraine peace talks following recent discussions in Berlin.
Intensive discussions were held between the U.S. envoys, notably Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, Ukrainian President Zelensky, and top European officials, and the outcomes were unexpectedly optimistic.
U.S. officials are claiming consensus has been reached on 90% of the core terms for an end-of-war deal.
That's right.
So if consensus is at 90%, what specifically remains the unresolved sticking point that prevents a final agreement?
Questions of territorial control remain highly sensitive. Russia continues to demand Ukrainian retreat from certain areas of the Donbass region. Additionally, the question of who ultimately controls the Zaporizhia power plant is unsettled.
But there was progress toward an agreement for a 50-50 split of the power output from the plant.
Yes, if not the operational control. Zelensky described the talks as producing a first draft with a solid military part.
And the most surprising consensus was reached regarding security guarantees for Ukraine, which involves the U.S. committing to a strong, legally binding defense structure.
Yes. Consensus was reached on Article 5-like security guarantees. This means a legally binding commitment for assistance, including armed force, intelligence sharing, and economic action in case of a future attack.
But crucially, the sources emphasize no U.S. troops deployed as part of this guarantee.
That's the key. And the administration official noted they believe they can get Russia to sign off on this, which surprised both Ukrainians and Europeans, given Moscow's historical opposition.
And if this is structured as a binding treaty, that requires a huge hurdle in the U.S. Senate.
Absolutely. Two-thirds Senate approval. It would establish a formal security commitment significantly stronger than the previous non-binding Budapest memorandum.
So what does this all mean when we synthesize the flood of activity from December 15th? I mean, the day was defined by the administration's focused effort on leveraging national security powers.
From defining fentanyl as a WMD to reshaping foreign policy around vital resource competition.
While simultaneously attempting aggressive internal reforms across public health, procurement of AI, and workforce management.
That's the precise synthesis. These seemingly disparate actions, the high-stakes fight over ACA subsidies, the State Department loyalty promotions, the fentanyl WMD order, and the Supreme Court's Holman ruling, they all converge on redefining the scope of federal power and accountability.
So the administration is using every lever available to advance its political and ideological agenda.
And insulating itself from legal accountability while forcing its will onto the career bureaucracy in preparation for the next election cycle. The speed and the scope of these changes, they're really unprecedented.
Here's the final provocative thought for you to consider as you process this truly dense deep dive. The federal government is simultaneously pursuing a pooled hiring model to recruit 1,000 highly paid, mission-driven technologists for the U.S. tech force, a move requiring significant resource investment and ambition, while issuing policy changes and enduring bureaucratic crises that are causing thousands of experienced career employees to exit the federal government, suffering month-long delays in their retirement payments. What will be the lasting legacy of this massive rapid turnover on the actual capacity, institutional memory, and overall effectiveness of the American bureaucracy?